The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
Look Who's Righteous Now by Daniel Rogers. Oh, no, he didn't. I reached the garden out of breath, sweating profusely. I'm supposed to do that. Curse my middle-aged legs. The young twit just finished pulling the last weed from the shaman's garden, giving him the lead in righteous acts for now. I still have time to prove I'm the most righteous, assuming I don't die first. And if we keep running like this, I might. The twit ran towards the temple to perform some other righteous act, but instead of giving chase, I moved deeper into the temple grounds, walking, not running. Bob the shaman explained that only the most righteous can win the pick-a-sacrifice tournament, but didn't explain how to be the most righteous. Perhaps it's more than just doing kind things for the shaman. An old priest carrying a large pitcher tripped and almost dropped it. Several younger priests stood around him gasping but did nothing to help. Now, this is a clearly righteous opportunity if I've ever seen one. I pushed through the crowd of worthless priests and attempted to grab the pitcher. Shockingly, the old priest pulled it away. The unhelpful priest gasped again as a drop of water tumbled over the edge and fell to the ground. Pandemonium erupted. Priests fell to the ground in frantic prayer. The old priest stood paralyzed with fear. Some priests ran like bees that just entered their robes, waving their arms and behaving as if the sky were falling. Okay, I know I'm not from this planet, but this is overkill, right? I mean, it's just a drop of water. What have you done? The old priest yelled. He remained completely still, like the pitcher would blow up if he dared move an inch. I'm just trying to help. You made me spill the sacred water from the latter god's well. The wailing prayers intensified. Okay, guys, that's enough. I can't think over your whining. One of the wailing priests stopped wailing long enough to chew me out. We must pray fervently for forgiveness for dropping the holy water, or the latter god will punish us. I didn't know about the latter god, but I'm about to punish them myself if they don't quit their obnoxious racket. I shook my head at the pathetic scene. Seriously, guys, there's nothing to get all excited about. That did it. They stopped wailing, looking at me like I had just kicked over a baby's stroller. Blasphemy. One whispered, too timid to come right out and say it. Soon the other priests joined in with defiant whispers of blasphemy. I'm not proud of what I did next, but seeing several men on their knees whispering blasphemy made me laugh. I just couldn't take them seriously. Now he laughs at the latter god, a priest whispered. You're going to have to stop this whispering thing, I said, and let me know how I can fix this. The old priest took charge and let me have it. You can't fix losing holy water. You must atone for the loss by sacrificing what you value most. It's the only way we can avoid punishment. My first thought was of Alora. He ain't getting her. She's the best android co-pilot I've ever had. Actually, she's the only android co-pilot I've ever had. But that's beside the point. Then there's my ship. But that's not going to happen either. What could I sacrifice? Do you have any suggestions? I asked. It's obvious. Resign from the pick-a-sacrifice tournament. There is nothing more valuable than sacrificing yourself to the latter god. When this tournament started, I wanted nothing more than to lose. And now that Alora talked me into winning, I have to give up? What kind of atonement can I get for a close second? The old priest said nothing. How can I let that young twit win when I've come so close? And if I don't win, how will I obtain the delanium needed for my powerless ship? The only source we found is at the top of the ladder god's ladder. But I can't allow them to be punished for my mistake. I'll do it. My shoulders drooped. I've lost. I just condemned us to rot on this primitive planet. The old priest led me to the ladder god's well and helped me through the ritual. It involved an odd dance going clockwise around the well with flailing arms and moving my knees like in the old Charleston dance. Then I had to dance counterclockwise around the well, moving like a wild ape. Finally, ending with a chant, I give what I value 3 times with a deep voice, followed by an additional 3 times with a shrill voice. Some said my shrill voice sounded more like a little girl screaming, but no matter how it sounded, the result ended my chance to win the tournament. At sunset, the priests escorted me and the twit to stand before Bob the shaman. He pounded his staff on the ground, signaling the beginning of the last ceremony before the great sacrifice. In a short while, Bob would announce this year's winner. Of course, I ruined the anticipation since everyone knew I resigned. Drew Williams and Tag have proven they are the most righteous by overcoming judgment, relying on faith, and demonstrating kindness and selflessness. These traits make a righteous man. Unfortunately, the great ladder god only accepts 1 sacrifice a year. Throughout this entire tournament, I still can't see the idea of sacrificing oneself as a good thing, but the locals can't get enough of it. They're just sorry they can only do it 1 a year. Kindness and selflessness are woven together like a braided rope. Without selflessness, kindness could be used to obtain favor and gain recognition. And while I'm on that note, I want to thank Tag for weeding my garden, polishing my silverware, dusting my bookshelves, including a few that didn't belong to me, and sweeping my bedroom, even though I was clearly napping at the time. I'm indebted to you, and you are obviously a really awesome person. The priest cheered and hooted. Tag bowed and acted all humble. But he had such a big head, you couldn't have fit it through the temple gates if you tried. I've never seen a more prideful person. Bob raised his staff to silence the crowd. However, Drew did something I've never seen. He selflessly sacrificed his greatest desire to help an old priest avoid punishment by resigning from the tournament. The priest mumbled with hushed tones. He demonstrated true kindness and selflessness, and since the rules clearly state that no one can resign from the tournament, I declare that Drew is the winner of the Pick a Sacrifice tournament. The priests went nuts, whistling, cheering, hooting, and bowing to anyone or anything. I saw one bow to a tree, looking very embarrassed, but still having a good time. It took a minute to sink in. I'm going to climb the ladder and find out what's really up there. I don't believe in ladder gods, but that ladder sure looks a lot like a ship's ladder. One way or another, I'm going to find out, but I really hope it's not a ladder god. That would really suck. I vanquished the thought from my mind because right now it's time to party. I just won the tournament. Look who's righteous now. Merging by Honey Homecroft. We were on the road to Lily's mother's house for Easter weekend when it happened. Black SUV going 90 drifted into our lane. "Honey," Lily had gasped. I turned to her just in time to see the other driver's red fingernails claw at the steering wheel. Her mouth opened in a silent scream. She sent us hurtling sideways, tumbling over the highway, Lily's limbs lurching like a marionette's, until we landed in a crash of metal and glass against cement. I tried to reach where Lily lay, but my arms wouldn't obey. Tried to call for her, but it seemed I couldn't speak. Acrid smoke from burning metal and pavement filled my lungs. I watched Lily's eyes slowly close until my vision faded to black, too. And then, like waking out of a nightmare, I was back at the wheel. Lily's eyes were open and animated as she discussed in detail what to expect after her Uncle Stan's fourth or fifth shot of Rajka. The smoke that had choked the breath from my lungs was gone. In its place, the aroma of the coffee she picked up at the gas station before we left, and a trace of coconut from her shampoo. "He's going to offer you a drink, but honestly, just stick to beer." The car was whole, sound, and facing the right way up. "In 2 miles, merge onto State Road 40 East," said the GPS. The road ahead of us stretched into the horizon, empty but for a couple semis lazily climbing the slope. No black SUV in sight. Still, my knees shook as I accelerated. The thundering of my still-alive heart claimed it must have been a nightmare. "Are you okay?" Lily's voice cut through my thoughts. "I'm sorry, I must have drifted off," I heard myself say, dazed and distant. "Really?" she said. "Maybe we should pull off at the next exit." "I'm okay now," I said. The sunset behind the storm clouds was beginning to cast the road in shadow. "We're almost there." I could tell that she wanted to argue. In the newness of our relationship, she bit her tongue a lot when I stayed up too late to play video games or had one more beer than I said I would. But I had seen her nose to nose with patients who wouldn't follow their doctor's orders, with men at the bar who couldn't take a hint. I reached for her hand. "I won't do it again." Her face relaxed into a wry smile. "You can't get out of meeting my family that easy." I let the black asphalt ahead smooth over the bad dream, whose tendrils seemed to be loosening their grip on my mind. "Honey," Lily gasped, the same sharp inhale from my nightmare. My head snapped to her to find a black SUV, the same black SUV, inches from the passenger side door. The same driver's red nails gripped the wheel. The world went sideways, again, a rolling kaleidoscope of spring sky and dark road. We hung suspended from our seats in a pantomime of falling. Lily's eyes closed, then mine. And when they opened again, I was back at the wheel with Lily chattering about her Uncle Stan, her Aunt Marty, the ham on the table. State Route 40, still 2 miles ahead. "We have to stop. We have to pull over," I said, craning my neck to check for black SUVs. "Why, are you all right?" We need to pull over." I could feel Lily silently evaluating me like she did some of her patients. "Exit 199 ahead has a rest stop," she said. Did that come before or after the crash? I couldn't remember. Whatever was happening to us, I couldn't remember the details of the sequence that led to our death. But no time to hesitate, I began to merge. "You have to signal," Lily called. "Honey?" The Black's SUV was at our back fender. I jerked the steering wheel left, not knowing a semi had pulled up on that side. And the result was the same, flying, crashing, waking up again at the wheel with my heart racing. "I need to pull over," I said. I didn't wait till the signs for the exit. We wouldn't make it. We sat under a swaying branch of a willow tree until we couldn't see it in the dark. I told Lily I just needed a rest, but I didn't explain why I kept watching the road. Surely it had been enough time. Surely whoever was in the black SUV had passed by now. But if it wasn't the SUV, it was a semi. If I slammed on the brakes, the two of them would collide, and we couldn't escape the wreckage anyway. If I stopped altogether in the middle of the highway, I couldn't prevent it, couldn't remember enough to plan our escape. Again and again, same endless road, same gasp, same end. "We should get back to the road," Lily said once, as we sat pulled over before the exit. "There's an ER by my mom's. We could stop there." She laid a soft hand across my forehead and peered into my face. I breathed in coconut. I tried to memorize the shape of her nose and fill my mind with the exact shade of green of her eyes. How many times now had I seen them close for the last time? I willed her to stay, just stay here with me. But that's never what happened. "Switch me, I'll drive," she said. If I refused, she'd roll me to the passenger side herself as if my entire adult frame weighed as much as a child's. She'd take my keys, call her mom as she started the car. "Something's wrong with Henry," she'd say in a panic. "Meet us at Fairview." But it would be dark already. She would merge onto the highway too slowly. Another car, the black SUV, would slam into us. She'd die apologizing to me, and I'd be back at the wheel, and she'd be chattering away again. Uncle Stan, his shots of Rajka, 2 miles to the 40, an empty road, a beautiful evening, until, "Honey, shut up," I snapped at her. This time I didn't turn to her, couldn't bear to see the trust she had in me, her eyes wide in open panic. One last time, so I didn't. Even without looking, I knew it was there, the black SUV on my right. Then I saw the semi on my left. No slowing down, no pulling off. I pressed the gas pedal to the floor, my shoulders scrunched against the roar of the engine, the sound of Lily screaming at me to stop, stop, stop. Jaw clenched and pulse pounding, I gunned past the semi, past the point in the road where we died, at last. The rest of the road unfolded, and I thought for a moment that I could cheer, I could kiss her. But Lily hissed, "You ass." And I couldn't remember why she was angry. As we drove, black asphalt smoothed over the memory of our deaths until all that was left was a tense silence in the car that I couldn't quite explain. The universe, where I would always choose to turn to Lily, now just a shimmer in the air, a crimping of light in the rearview mirror like a mirage. The Neverborn by Jack Kimball. Year 2130 CE. The high rises in Abu Dhabi rose into the gray sky and lost themselves. Were they real? Amar Rabak cocked his head at the shimmer on the building's edge. This was the giveaway, he decided. What is real and what isn't? It was exhausting to live in a world where truth no longer mattered. He stared up, and when he did, he stumbled on the marble steps he was climbing. The steps were real. The world's Supreme Court was real. Above him were the words carved into the Romanesque architecture. They didn't shimmer. It was just he couldn't tell where the sky began. He would have fallen if she hadn't caught him. Dr. Ellie Randolph took his arm and held it a moment and looked at him. She smiled, though her eyes did not smile. "We don't want to lose you now," she said. "David beats Goliath. You remember that?" Amir swallowed. "I don't feel much like David." "Don't worry," she said. "Marquez will throw it out, and you'll go back to traffic court, and then Proxima will hunt you down, and that'll be the end of it." He nodded. He noticed Ellie wore red heels and the same red shade on her lips, and it didn't belong in a place like this, but she wore them anyway. He held her arm longer than he meant to, and then let go. He closed his eyes, breathed, and they went inside. The chamber was full already, and the voices were low. No one turned to look at them, but he could still feel them looking. Marquez sat above them. After a moment, she said, "Counsel, please begin." Amir stood, though for a moment he didn't feel his legs. The room had gone still in that particular way, hundreds of people pretending not to move. Even the air felt held back. "Counsel?" Justice Marquez said. He swallowed. His notes were in front of him. Why didn't he look at them? "Your Honor, the Proxima B initiative claims they transport human beings to the planet K2 18B in the constellation of Leo. His voice came out thinner than he wanted. He steadied it. We intend to show they transport nothing. A pause. He let it sit. Ellie had drilled the coaching into him. Leave space. Let them lean forward. They copy, he said. Something shifted in the gallery. Not loud, just a change in posture. Amir felt it and kept going. They have built a system that records a human being down to the molecular and neural level, transmits that information, and reconstructs it at a distant location. The person who arrives believes they are the original. He glanced just once toward the defense table. They are not. On what basis do you make that claim? Marquez asked. On the physics, Amir said, and on the outcome. He turned slightly. I called Dr. Ellie Randolph. Ellie didn't rush. She never did. The sound of her heels cut across the floor was sharp and deliberate. She stepped into position and didn't look at Amir. Her attention went straight to the bench. Doctor, Marquez said, keep this clear. Ellie gave a small nod. I'll try. A projection came alive behind her, flat at first, a flat gray plane suspended in the air. Space, she said, at least the way we model it. With a flick of her hand, the plane bent, not dramatically, just enough to suggest a living thing twisting in 3D space. Distances aren't fixed. Under certain conditions, space-time can curve, fold enough. The plane tightened, edges drawing inward, and two distant points can be brought into contact. Two markers appeared, Earth, K2-18B. They hovered apart, then slid together as the surface warped. A murmur ran through the room. The concept isn't new. Solution to Einstein's equations allow for what we call wormholes, pathways between distant regions. She let the image hold. Then, they don't stay open. The surface snapped back flat. The two markers separated again. Under normal conditions, the structure collapses almost instantly. You can't pass matter through it. Not meaningfully. Not anything as complex as a human body. Yet Proxima claims they can, Marquez said. They claim they have stabilized it, Ellie said, expanded it, made it usable. And you disagree? Ellie paused. Not long, just enough. I disagree with what they say they're doing, she said, not with what they've built. That drew the first real reaction from the defense table. A shift. One of the attorneys leaned forward toward another. Marquez caught it. Go on, doctor. Ellie's gaze moved briefly to the defense, then back. They've stabilized a microscopic wormhole throat. That much is plausible. Given enough energy and the right form of exotic matter. She let the words settle. But stability doesn't solve the transport problem. Explain that. You don't move a human body through that structure, Ellie said. You can't. The energy requirements alone, she stopped herself, recalibrated. They're not just high, they're nuclear. So what does move? Marquez asked. Ellie's hand lowered, the projection dimmed slightly behind her. Information is duplicated at the exit node. A complete scan, molecular position, neural state, every synapse, every electrochemical pattern. She didn't raise her voice. That data is transmitted. At the destination, a body is assembled to match it. And the original? Marquez said. Ellie didn't answer right away. Across the room, Blackwell's attorney stood up, smooth, controlled. Objection, Your Honor. This is speculative framing. The Proxima B initiative has demonstrated. Sit down. Marquez looked back at Ellie. The original doctor? Ellie's eyes didn't leave the bench. The original has to be accounted for, she said. That's not an answer. No, Ellie said quietly, it isn't. Another pause, longer this time. If the system disassembles the body as part of the scan and all evidence suggests it does, then the original is destroyed. A ripple, sharper now, someone in the gallery breathed in loudly. And what arrives? Marquez asked. Ellie's voice didn't change. A copy, she said. Blackwell's attorney was on his feet again. There is no evidence. This isn't your turn. It's a mischaracterization of established... Sit down. Marquez leaned forward slightly. Dr. Randolph, are you telling this court that every individual sent through this system is killed? Ellie held her gaze. I'm saying, she said, that something dies and something else wakes up believing it didn't. 3,000 kilometers away, Daniel Carter slept fitfully, haunted by a dream he did not yet understand. He stood in a hallway infinite in its length, mirrors stretched on both ends, one before him, one behind. At first, the reflections were normal. Each movement he made echoed down the corridor. Then something shifted. The mirrors displayed him slightly out of sync, a fraction of a second behind, a fraction ahead. As he watched, the reflections began to age, a little stooped, a little worn, faces carrying lives he had never lived. A subtle panic rose in him. One of the reflections looked directly at him, not reflecting, but observing. He woke, gasping, the images etched in his mind. He was terrified by the dream. Ellen! His wife was in the kitchen. He waited for her. He knew she would hold him and look in his eyes with the same expression he remembered on their wedding day. I love you, she'd say, and hold his face with her hands and then sweep his long hair behind his ears. Why are you so frightened? Is it the dream again? He could remember his wife caressing the side of his cheek with her palm, the cool warmth of it. He sensed she shared his fear, his tenseness, and he avoided her eyes. But it was feeling his wife's trembling that broke his heart. His son clambered through the bedroom door and jumped into his lap, the 7-year-old's curious blue eyes looking up at him, his dad. It's okay, he remembered his son saying. It's okay. The three of them were at a park. It was spring and the sun shining. They'd packed a lunch and later they would picnic on the lake. Their dog, Squire, would chase the frisbee he tossed into the water. Squire would bound after the blue disc, his golden collie fur wet and flying. He'd bring back the disc again and again. He remembered his life in moments. Your Honor, I'd like to recall Mr. Lloyd Blackwell to testify once again as the owner and CEO of Proxima Industries. Mr. Blackwell, please take the stand. Blackwell leaned back in the witness chair, his face a pasty white, but it was his eyes that made Amir shudder. They were intelligent, radiating, and void of human empathy. Amir thought of cliched, smoke-filled rooms. Mr. Blackwell, Proxima has a patented monopoly on transporting human beings to another star system. Could you explain how this works? Space curves, Blackwell said, as space-time folds together. Two points, one on Earth, the other on K2-18b, can touch. From light years apart? Yes, 124 light years, actually. Certain solutions of Einstein's equations allow what physicists call wormholes, tunnels connecting distant regions of space-time. Simple, really, in hindsight. Yet, Amir asked, isn't it also true that wormholes historically collapsed almost instantly under ordinary gravitational forces? It is true, yes. Scientists couldn't, at first, over 100 years ago now, transmit anything bigger than the smallest of particles across a lab, let alone humans. So what changed? Using the sun's energy, we now transport humans to K2-18b in less than a second. in a quiet house outside Boston. Daniel sat at the kitchen table. A cup of coffee sat untouched before him. He could still feel the dream pressing against his thoughts, the infinite mirrors. Anna moved in the background, precise in her motions, washing dishes. His son, James, shuffled into the room, pajama rockets printed on his sleeves. Their dog, Squire, stirred under the table. "Dad," James said, "are you really going to another star?" Daniel nodded. "Yes." "How long?" "No one's exactly sure," Daniel said. "Will you miss my birthday?" "Maybe the first one," Daniel said. Anna leaned against the counter with her eyes trained on him. "I know they pay us. Lord knows we need the money, but what have they told you?" "Something about quantum teleportation and wormholes." She shook her head. "You said wormhole experiments did not allow for human transportation. Just particles across a lab." Daniel laughed weakly. "Small beginnings." "Your nightmares, what about that?" Daniel laughed nervously. "Hallucinations." "What if they're not? You need to call Amir." "And do what?" "Amir is more friend than attorney." "Call him and tell him about your nightmares. Let him know about Proxima." "The Proxima B initiative has a monopoly on space travel," Blackwell continued. "We've stabilized a microscopic wormhole, expanded it, and developed a quantum matter transfer protocol." "You're transferring humans?" "We move what we're paid to move," Blackwell said. "Humans? Among other things." Amir glanced back at Ellie. She took Amir's place. "We declare the patent void, Your Honor. Proxima is not transferring anything. They are copying data, duplicating it." Blackwell's lead attorney stood up, eyes sharp. "Objection, Your Honor. There is no evidence Proxima is duplicating human beings. The technology transfers live human matter. That is all proven science." "Overruled. I want to hear this. Go on," Ellie continued. "Their protocol allows a complete informational scan of a human being. Every molecule, every neuron. The information then travels through a wormhole, stabilized with exotic matter." "What's your point?" The judge glanced back at Beck. "Well, you're wasting the court's time." "The protocol does not transport matter," Ellie said. "It creates a duplicate on Proxima B. The original body remains, or if it is destroyed, which is the same as killing the original. Any copy generated at K218B is independent, but the original human being's continued existence should maintain its legal and moral status." Ellie gestured a finger directly at Blackwell. "Just because you can duplicate a human on another planet doesn't mean you can discard the original." The facility appeared out of a pink dawn as Daniels rode with security men in a jeep. The building waited, a pale stoned rampart, an isolated observatory on a rising butte, alone in the flat desert. They brought him in and antennas circled a central chamber before him. A low thrum hummed in the air. A man dressed in white with a hairnet explained he was a technician. He attached sensors to Daniel's temple and arms. One of the sensors was loose, and the man used duct tape to affix the wire. "That will do." Daniel followed the technician to the chamber's center, where they placed him on a table, much like a dentist's chair. A metallic ring glimmered around a cube at the room's center. Within the cube, the throat of the wormhole shimmered, and the entry pulsated much like it was swallowing air, the tunnel surface pink and gulping. Justice Marquez nodded slowly. "And this relates to Proxima how?" "Proxima has not sent volunteers to Centauri B," Amir replied. "People like our client, Daniel Carter, inherit memories of a family they never had. The duplicates on are templates who have no legal standing under Earth law." Proxima has classified the duplicates on K2-18b under a special interstellar treaty, defining them as colonial labor assets, not citizens. Mr. Blackwell? Blackwell leaned forward. The process is voluntary. No human is harmed. All scans are performed with consent. Justice Marquez frowned. And yet the claim is duplicates classify as labor assets. Is that true? Mr. Carter, we're beginning the quantum matter transfer. You must hold perfectly still in order for the scan to record all of your molecular and neural structures. Without an instantiate, we may not get a full duplicate at Proxima B. Okay. Beginning quantum matter transfer, the technician said. And my original? Disassembled during scanning. Daniel nodded. In front of him, Ellen's hand pressed to the observatory glass. His son stared from beside her. They were escorted out as he opened his mouth to say goodbye. Then the pulse began. Light crawled along his arms and legs. The hum deepened and his chest vibrated. The hum now increased to a screech, and he howled with his back arched against the chair. The room stretched, walls bending imperceptibly. A red glow from the throat of the tunnel reached for him. Daniel Carter vanished. Isn't it true, Mr. Blackwell, that the duplicates inherit the neural patterns of their originals? Yes. Isn't it true that memories of families, homes, pets duplicate from a preserved human neuron template? Yes, Blackwell said, but under an interstellar treaty, they exist outside Earth law. Their status is legal and clearly outside Earth jurisdiction from interfering. But how can this be true if the original human remains on Earth? What do you do with the sourced human after the transfer? Blackwell hesitated. He glanced at his team. Well, we harvest, store the neuron and molecular patterns to use when we send other templates. You what? The justice leaned into his bench. These have not been actual people for over 100 years. We are creating the never-born. Daniel woke lying on metal. Red dust filled the sky. Around him, hundreds of men stirred, identical faces just like his own. A guard walked down the aisle. Welcome to Proxima Mining Colony. Another man approached with his face. They sat in silence, watching hundreds of identical workers labor beneath floodlights. Do you remember them? The other asked. My family? Yes, Daniel nodded. I remember saying goodbye. Across the distance stretched a mining camp. Daniel thought of the mirrors. A whistle sounded, and he rose with the others and took his place in line. As he did, he pictured a porch, a boy waving, a dog barking, a woman smiling. Maybe they had existed once, maybe not. But the memory was enough to keep him moving. Beneath the red sky. The Last Walk from Ravensdale Woods by Alexander Colfer. The leprechaun clawed its way through the hardened earth, each movement agony as radiation-poisoned soil crumbled about him. The mound in Ravensdale Woods, once his sacred dwelling, had collapsed inward, the ancient magic barely sustaining its structure. He emerged into a world transformed, gasping as unfamiliar air filled lungs that had not breathed for 15 years. What remained of the woods stretched before him like a blackened skeleton. Trees stood as charred sentinels, their branches reaching skyward in permanent supplication. The protective canopy that had sheltered his kind for millennia was gone, leaving him exposed to a sickly yellow sky. He stood 7 feet tall, but stooped now with weakness. His skin, once the rich texture of oak bark, had faded to sickly ashen gray. The eyes that had terrified young Helen Colfer over a century ago were dulled, the bog water green now murky and clouded. He pulled his once moss-green coat about him, which had become brown and threadbare, as if to ward off the cold. "The land dies, and so do I," he whispered, his voice a dry, whispery rasp where once it had rumbled like distant thunder. As he steadied himself against a blackened tree stump, he felt the stirring within. Deep within his essence, he felt them, his children that he had absorbed after the bombs fell. Their voices, once a chorus of wild music in his mind, had diminished to faint whispers. They had been his last connection to the old world, these half-human offspring born of Helen and others who had broken promises over the centuries. When the radiation had poisoned the earth, he had drawn them back into himself, consuming their essence to survive the long winter. A terrible choice, but necessary. Better to preserve some fragment of the Eos Sea than to let their magic dissipate into nothing. "Forgive me," he murmured to their fading presence. "Your sacrifice will not be wasted." He turned toward what had once been Enniscorthy, driven by an instinct older than memory. If any humans had survived, they would need water and shelter. They would rebuild near the river as they always had. The journey that once took mere minutes now required hours. His legs, once swift enough to outrun any mortal, trembled with each step. The radiation had seeped into the very bedrock, poisoning the ley lines that had nourished his kind since before humans first set foot on Irish soil. He passed the remains of farmhouses, their stones scattered like broken teeth. Fields where cattle once grazed lay barren, the soil crusted and lifeless. Occasionally, he encountered the bleached bones of those who had not found shelter, grim markers on his pilgrimage through devastation. Enniscorthy appeared on the horizon, a jagged silhouette against the sickly sky. The town where Helen had lived, where her son Thomas had grown into a monster, where countless generations had been born and died while he watched from his woodland sanctuary. When he finally reached the outskirts of what had once been Enniscorthy, the devastation took his breath away. The town was a blackened mound of ruin. Though spared direct impact, firestorms had swept through the after the bombs fell on Dublin, Belfast, Cork, and Wexford. Buildings that had stood for centuries were reduced to hollow shells, their windows gaping like empty eye sockets, their roofs collapsed inward. The leprechaun moved through streets littered with the detritus of civilization's end. Rusted vehicles, their paint blistered and peeled, shop windows shattered, their contents long since looted, and everywhere bones, scattered by scavengers, bleached by unfiltered sunlight, silent witnesses to humanity's folly. The church where Helen had once prayed stood partially intact. Its spire collapsed, but its walls still defiant. He paused before it, reflecting on the pointlessness of its structure and the inaction of the God it represented. "Your God did not save you," he murmured, "as mine all abandon us to this fate." Finding no signs of life in the town, he turned back south towards Brownswood. The journey was arduous, each step draining his dwindling strength. The radiation had affected him differently than humans. Slower, more insidious, corrupting the ancient magic that sustained him rather than destroying his physical form outright. He followed what remained of the road, occasionally stopping to rest against tumbled stone walls, half buried in ash and ice. The countryside showed faint signs of recovery, sparse patches of hardy grass pushing through the gray soil, insects buzzing in the stillness, a thin lone fox watching warily from a distance. Nature was resilient, even after mankind's worst. But the old magic was fading, and with it, his kind. He was the last. He knew this with certainty. Across Ireland, across the world, the Fae had withdrawn into their mounds and hidden spaces as the bombs fell, and none had emerged. Their voices he would normally have heard gently chattering in his mind were silent as the grave. As twilight approached, his weary steps brought him to a sign that kindled a faint hope. The cottage appeared as the sickly sun began to set. A small stone structure nestled against a hillside, its slate roof partially collapsed and repaired with sheets of corrugated sheet tied together with twisted wire, but its walls intact. A thin wisp of tired smoke rose from the chimney, the first sign of human presence he had encountered. He approached cautiously, his senses, though diminished, alert for danger. The cottage door hung askew on leather hinges, and through the gap he could see movement within. A figure hunched by a small fire, stirring something in a dented pot. The leprechaun paused at the threshold, ancient courtesy preventing him from entering uninvited. He knocked once on the wooden frame, the sound startlingly loud in the stillness. The figure inside then reached for something, a weapon, no doubt. "Who's there?" called a male voice, young but roughened by hardship. "A traveler," the leprechaun replied, his voice barely above a whisper, "seeking shelter for the night." The man who emerged from the shadows moved with the caution of prey, tall and gaunt, with the wiry strength of one who had survived on too little for too long. His face was partially obscured by a makeshift mask of cloth, his eyes hidden behind dark goggles fashioned from scavenged materials. "You're alone?" the man asked, a crude spear held ready in his hands. "I am the last of my kind," the leprechaun replied truthfully. The man studied him for a long moment, then lowered his weapon slightly. "You don't look too sick. No radiation burns I can see." "I suffer differently," the leprechaun said. After another moment's hesitation, the man stepped back. "Come in, then. Not much point in caution anymore. I'm Sean." "Sean," the leprechaun repeated, tasting the name. A good Irish name, ancient in its way. "You may call me Findara, Finn, if it pleases you." The interior of the cottage was sparse but orderly. Sean had created a living space from salvaged materials, furniture repaired with wire and twine, walls patched with metal sheets, windows covered with translucent plastic that filtered the harmful light. "Sit," Sean offered, gesturing to a chair by the small fire. "I don't have much, but I can share." The leprechaun sat, his tall frame awkward in the human-sized chair. He watched as Sean ladled a thin stew into two mismatched bowls. The food was simple. Some root vegetables, what might have been rabbit meat, and herbs that had somehow survived. "This is your last food," the leprechaun observed. Sean shrugged. "I'll find more. Always do." He pushed a bowl toward his visitor. "Eat. You look like you need it more than me." The leprechaun accepted the offering, understanding its significance. In the old days, to share food with the Fae created a bond, an obligation. Even now, with the old ways dying, the gesture held power. As they ate, Sean removed his goggles, revealing eyes clouded with cataracts, the result of exposure to unfiltered ultraviolet radiation. Though barely 30, hardship had aged him beyond his years. "I was 15 when it happened," Sean began without prompting. "In school, an ordinary day. Then the lights, brighter than anything. We thought it was the end of the world, which in all the ways that mattered, it was." The leprechaun listened as Sean recounted the fall of civilization, the initial panic, the government radio broadcasts that grew increasingly desperate before ceasing altogether, the mass exodus from the towns that survived, the violence that followed as food grew scarcer and the sun hid behind a freezing gray fog. "Dublin, Cork, Wexford, and Belfast were hit directly," Sean continued, "but it was what came after that killed most people. The fires, followed by nuclear winter. Crops failed, livestock died. People turned on each other and took to eating corpses of anything." He described years of darkness and cold, ash blocking the sun, temperatures plummeting, everlasting winter. communities formed and fractured, disease that spread through weakened populations. The strong preyed on the weak until they too succumbed. My father lasted 10 years, taught me everything he knew about surviving. My mother died earlier from cancer, probably from the radiation. I've been here alone for 5 years now. Your great-grandmother, the leprechaun said carefully. What was her name? Great-Granny Helen, Helen Culver. The name sent a ripple through the leprechaun's weakened form. He sniffed and tilted his head to one side. I smell her in you, he said, more statement than question. Sean looked up, surprised. Great-Granny Helen. Never knew her, though. Dad said she died when his dad was born. He was always telling stories about her, left from the diaries she had religiously filled in every day. How could you know that? The leprechaun studied Sean's features, seeing now the echoes of Helen in the shape of his jaw, the set of his shoulders. The bloodline had continued despite everything, despite Thomas's darkness, despite the end of the world. I knew your family, he said simply, long ago. Sean leaned forward, squinting through damaged eyes. You can't be that old, unless, his hand tightened on his spear. What are you? I am AOC, the leprechaun said, allowing his glamour to fade slightly. His features sharpened, became more angular, less human. His eyes flickered briefly with their old bog water light. What your people once called leprechaun, though that name never captured what we truly were. Sean's breath caught. The stories. My great-grandmother left stories about something in Ravensdale Woods, about a bargain she made. Helen, the leprechaun confirmed. She promised to visit me, to keep me company in my solitude. When she broke that promise, I took half her life as payment. She died giving birth to your grandfather. Sean's face hardened. And my grandfather? My dad said he disappeared. He came to the woods one night with darkness in his heart. My children took what remained of his life force. Your children? Sean's voice was barely audible. Half human, half fey, born of broken promises and collected debts. They sleep within me now, what little remains of them. The leprechaun's voice grew softer, almost tender when speaking of his children. Why are you here? Sean asked after a long silence. Have you come to collect another debt? The leprechaun shook his head slowly. I have come to pay one. He explained how the nuclear devastation had poisoned the ancient magic, how the Fae were bound to the land in ways humans could never understand. As the earth sickened, so did they. One by one, they had faded, their very essence bleeding into the wounded earth. I absorbed my children to survive longer, he admitted. A selfish act, perhaps, but I sensed something, a purpose not yet fulfilled. He reached across the table, his long fingers hovering near Sean's face. May I? After a moment's hesitation, Sean nodded. The leprechaun's touch was gentle as he traced the contours of Sean's damaged eyes. The radiation has taken much from you. Your sight fades. Soon you will be blind. I know, Sean whispered. You showed kindness to a stranger, shared your last food. Such actions once had meaning in the old world. Perhaps they will have meaning in the new one as well. For a moment, the leprechaun hesitated. This final act would end thousands of years of existence, the last of his kind surrendering what remained of ancient magic to a human. Yet in Sean's damaged eyes, he saw something that reminded him of Helen, not her betrayal, but her initial compassion, her willingness to see him as more than a monster. Perhaps this was why he had survived when all others had faded, this final chance at redemption. The leprechaun placed both hands on Sean's face, palms covering the clouded eyes. What remains of my life force I give freely. The last magic of the O.C. passed to the bloodline of Helen Culver. Light bloomed between his palms and Sean's face, not the sickly yellow of the irradiated sky, but the deep verdant green of ancient forests. Sean gasped, his body arching as the magic flowed into him. The leprechaun felt himself diminishing, the thousands of centuries of his existence unraveling like old rugs. The children within him stirred one last time, their voices rising in a final chorus before fading into silence. When he removed his hands, Sean blinked in wonder, his eyes clear and bright. "I can see," he whispered. "Everything's so vivid." Leprechaun smiled, his form already growing transparent. "The gift carries responsibility. You will father children. They will rebuild. They will remember." "You're dying," Sean realized, reaching out to touch the leprechaun's fading form. "Returning to the earth," the leprechaun corrected, "as all things must." His voice was growing fainter, his tall frame slumping as the magic that had sustained him for millennia ebbed away. "I have one request, Sean Colfer." "Anything," Sean promised. "Scatter what remains of me in the field beside this cottage, but upon the surface, where the sun's light may reach." Sean nodded, tears streaming from his newly healed eyes. "I will." "The fates have decided," the leprechaun whispered. "The circle closes. Mayhap the old magic will return. Mayhap it won't." His form shimmered once more, then collapsed inward like autumn leaves caught in a sudden gust. Where he had sat remained only a long heap of earth, rich and dark and fragrant with possibilities. 1 year later, as the brightening skies gently warmed the summer land, Sean stood at the edge of the orchard that had sprung from the field where he had spread the leprechaun's remains. Trees heavy with fruit stretched in neat rows, apple, pear, plum, and others he couldn't name, varieties that had been thought lost forever. The soil here remained fertile, despite the radiation that still poisoned much of the land. Birds nested in the branches. Fat bees hummed among the blossoms that somehow bloomed regardless of season. At the center of the orchard stood a single oak sapling, its leaves an impossible shade of green. Sean had found just over 1,000 survivors in the years that followed. They were drawn to the miraculous grove like moths to flame. A community formed around Sean's cottage, growing stronger with every passing season. They built traditional white-limed, mud-walled, thatched-roof cottages. They called the place New Ravenswood, though none but Sean knew the significance of the name. The survivors brought what skills they had, farming, medicine, crafting, and slowly, a semblance of civilization returned. Children born after the devastation showed unusual resilience to the lingering radiation. Their eyes clear and bright like Sean's had become. Some whispered that the orchard's fruit had healing properties, though Sean kept the true source of this miracle to himself. Sometimes in the quiet hours before dawn, Sean would take his stick and painfully shuffle to the old oak tree in the middle of the orchard and place his liver-spotted hand against its trunk. He could almost feel a heartbeat there, a rhythm ancient and patient. "The circle comes," he would whisper, and the leaves would rustle in response, though no wind stiffened the air. Gently stroking the bark, Sean closed his eyes and listened to the sweet birdsong from the surrounding orchard. "A man's worth is no greater than their ambitions, and your sacrifice gave me the purpose to dream beyond just surviving day to day and to grow a community with hope and love at its heart." Sean's old and cracked lips kissed the bark, and he murmured a quiet thank you for the last gift of the AOC. Not an ending, but a new beginning, another chance to put things right and live in harmony with the earth, and maybe one day its fairy folk, should they ever return.